Here at The Guardian, we love podcasts. Not only do we make dozens of award winners ourselves, but we also write about our favourite podcasts from around the world too. Every week, our column Hear Hear, that's here as in hearing and here as in where, comes out filled with recommendations from you, our listeners. We sift through them all to find the hidden gems that the podcasting world has to offer. These podcasts are often small yet mighty productions, which you probably wouldn't find highlighted on your usual podcatchers. So, if you're looking for your next podcast or have one that you want to share with the world, sign up for our weekly Hear Hear newsletter at theguardian.com/podmail and send us an email at podcasts@theguardian.com.
Hello and welcome to the Books Podcast. I'm Sian Kane. Lisa Halliday's debut novel, Asymmetry, is a story told in three parts. It opens with Alice, a young New York publisher who falls into a relationship with Ezra, an older Pulitzer Prize-winning author. Halfway through, it jumps to the perspective of an Iraqi-American man being detained at Heathrow, then jumps to a transcription of Ezra's appearance on the radio program Desert Island Discs. As a whole, Asymmetry is a dizzying dissection of the novel as a form, as she described to Richard Lee when she came into the studio. We begin with a reading.
"Mary Alice," he said tenderly a moment later, "I know what you're up to." "What?" "I know what you do when you're alone." "What?" "You're writing, aren't you?" Alice shrugged. "A little." "Do you write about this? About us?" "No." "Is that true?" Alice shook her head hopelessly. "It's impossible." He nodded. "Then what do you write about?" "Other people. People more interesting than I am." She laughed softly, lifting her chin toward the street. "Muslim hot dog sellers." Ezra looked skeptical. "Do you write about your father?" "No." "You should. It's a gift." "I know, but writing about myself doesn't seem important enough." "As opposed to?" "War, dictatorships, world affairs." "Forget about world affairs. World affairs can take care of themselves. They're not doing a very good job of it." A woman from Ezra's building came down the path, wearing a Gore 2000 cap and power walking a Shih Tzu. "Hello," Ezra said as she passed. "Hello, Chaucer," he added to the dog. For her part, Alice was starting to consider really rather seriously whether a former choir girl from Massachusetts might be capable of conjuring the consciousness of a Muslim man, when Ezra turned back to her and said, "Don't worry about importance. Importance comes from doing it well. Just remember what Chekhov said. If there's a gun hanging on the wall in the first chapter, in a later chapter, it must go off." Alice wiped her hands and stood to throw her napkin away. "If there's a defibrillator hanging on the wall in the first chapter, in a later chapter, must it go off?"
When Alan Finkielkraut asked Philip Roth in 1981 whether his book should be read as confessional, the novelist replied he had nothing to confess, that calling them autobiographical or confessional was an obstacle between the reader and the work, a slight on the skill that makes some readers think they might be real, adding, "You don't create the aura of intimacy by dropping your pants in public." Despite the echoes of your own relationship with Philip Roth while working in a New York literary agency, would you resist calling your story of an affair between a young editorial assistant and an older Pulitzer Prize-winning author autobiographical?
Yes.
And for the same reason?
Yes, exactly. I agree with that quote wholeheartedly. It is something that comes up again and again. It simply isn't the case that you write down something that's happened to you and voila, you have a compelling narrative. There's a lot of invention, a lot of imagination, recasting, reconjuring. I recently had reason to go back to a favorite book of my childhood, Little Women. It's a favorite book of many people. And there's a wonderful line in it where Jo March, who has become a writer, has published a book, and the reviews are by turn making her ecstatic and enraged. And she says, "But then I have the joke on my side after all. For the things that I took from real life, are being denounced as impossible and absurd, whereas the things that I made up out of my own silly little head are being pronounced charmingly natural, tender, and true.
So you think people just don't get how hard it is?
Yes, exactly. And I think that that's what makes fiction writers most upset. Not that people think something that happened on page 23 actually happened to you. That's not the problem. The problem is it seems to underestimate how much work really has gone into it to create the details that make a scene vivid and the narrative trajectory that keeps you turning the pages. That's what rubs writers the wrong way.
So was one of the ambitions for the book to sort of out-Roth Roth?
Oh, no, I'm not sure I could. I'm capable of doing that. Certainly, I had his work in mind. I'm a huge fan. The idea of autofiction, which is a term that I wasn't even aware of until my agent mentioned it to me soon after taking on the book. It's a very slippery term to my mind. I don't really understand it because I think all fiction relies to an extent on personal experience, even fiction that doesn't seem to. So, in fact, on my way here, I was wondering, does autofiction really refer to fiction that is autobiographical, or is it actually meant to refer to fiction that is designed to make the reader think it's autobiographical?
I think people sometimes think of it as a kind of a firm category, that there could be a dividing line between one sort of writing and another, whereas it seems very much more that there's a kind of spectrum of possibilities, and some books may even navigate across that boundary.
Yes. I think the reason that people are so fixated on what's real and what isn't real is in part because of the age we live in, the age of fake news and alternative facts and the superabundance of information that's available to us over the internet, and yet you just don't know what is true or fabricated or spun in a way to persuade people of a certain idea. So people are almost indignant sometimes about a novel in asking, well, what is real, what isn't real? But we would be here forever if we were to go through and I were to tell you, this happened, this didn't happen, this is something someone said to me in 2015, not in 2004, et cetera, et cetera. And again, so much is invented, so much is imagined. Some days you work for 5 hours and wind up with one, maybe two sentences, and that's because so much thinking is going into it. And that just wouldn't be the case if you were simply to transcribe what happened to you on a Sunday in 2005.
You say that people are underestimating this effort. Was one of the difficulties a way of finding enough distance between yourself and Alice?
No, I don't mean to suggest people are underestimating the effort. I meant more generally, one hears this about fiction. And indeed, one hears it about nonfiction. I think people who write nonfiction are very vulnerable to the accusation that they've made things up. And people get very angry about that as well. So you sort of get it coming and going.
Exactly symmetrical.
Yeah, yes. Yeah.
But is that one of the reasons why you framed her story in the third person, to keep it a little bit apart?
That's interesting. Yes, I suppose. But also, I think a woman in her 20s is still learning about herself, and a first-person voice, I don't want to say I would never use it for someone in her 20s or in his 20s, but I think a first-person voice in this case would have bumped up against so much doubt and ambivalence, not about the relationship, but just about who she is and who she wants to become, whereas it seemed a much more appropriate voice for an older character who's reflecting back on his life.
As you say, the second section leaps into the first person with this story of an Iraqi-American economist who's detained at Heathrow. How did you come up with the notion of putting these two stories together?
Well, on the subject of autobiography versus fiction, I should say that I was detained at Heathrow.
That's a fact.
Yes, overnight.
As a person of interest.
Yes, as a person of interest. And this is in part to make the point that in many ways Amar is more like I am than the character in the first part of the book. But I initially, when working on this book, was trying to combine those two stories in what seemed to me too false a way. I was trying to intertwine them. Maybe Alice and Amar knew each other and were friends who could teach each other things. And this just seemed to me very stale, something I'd seen many times in novels, and it felt forced. I felt as though I were shoehorning the characters together.
But you had an idea from the start that they were in some sense, you wanted them in the same place.
In the same world. But I didn't know how exactly they would be in that same world. I knew that I wanted to write about a woman who wanted to be a writer and who had had an important relationship that contributed to her education in becoming a writer. And also I wanted to write about someone feeling the anxiety of influence, which is very strong when you know established writers and when you work in publishing, and I presume even when you don't. But I also wanted to write about something very, very different as a way of learning and as a way of experimenting with how imagination breeds empathy, if it does. I'm very interested in the connection between the two. So that was why I wanted to write about a character like Amar. It was not until I had been working on some very unsuccessful drafts for at least a couple of years that I got the idea to separate out the stories, and I don't want to give too much away, but to establish their connection in a different way. And once I did that, I felt really liberated. It also seemed to me much more representative of the world in an impressionistic way that I liked, that seemed fresh and truer to me.
It was one of the part of this decision to put them together. Was it also partly a way of responding to debates about cultural appropriation?
Absolutely. Well, first of all, the debate in a recent iteration involving Lionel Shriver, I think I had finished the book by then, so I wasn't responding to that. However, I do agree with the point that if fiction writers aren't allowed to imagine their way into people unlike themselves, into characters unlike, then what are we doing? What is the point? The argument almost seems to suggest that we are only allowed to write about ourselves.
That we're just left with memoir.
Yes, yes.
As Shriver says.
And yes, and how do we learn what we don't know about other people if we're not allowed to try to write about them?
Do you understand the concerns expressed by people on the other side?
I absolutely understand the concerns. And I think that an enormous amount of responsibility must be assumed, and one must do it with tremendous humility, expecting to get it wrong, but also admitting that mistakes might be made, and yet they're made with the best of intentions. And again, this is how we learn what we don't know about each other. If you haven't heard what I think it's like to be someone like Amar, how can you tell me what I don't know? How can I learn how I've gotten it wrong? And how can we become closer as a result?
Do you think that the problem becomes contested when the issue is wrapped up in asymmetries of power?
I don't understand the question.
Well, it seems to me that people aren't quibbling with the idea that a middle-aged man in Hampstead could imagine what his middle-aged neighbour next door in Hampstead might feel. But as soon as that neighbour is in fact on a sink estate up the road, or like Amar, comes from a place which has been politically dominated by another country or by his country, where these asymmetries of power or sex or gender or exist, is that where the concerns are drawn up? And do we need more care?
I think it is, although I'm not sure anyone would have an issue with me trying to write from the perspective of a royal figure.
I guess that's kicking upwards rather than kicking down.
Exactly. But yes, I suppose it is caught up in that. It's a very interesting, complicated issue, and I certainly wouldn't want to pretend I have all the answers to it. I think it's important to not feel censored. I think it's important not to do something in a reckless, hasty way that quite obviously suggests you are only out to benefit, not to learn, and not to bridge the gap between who you are and who this other person, this character is. So the book is very much about this, how someone like Lisa Halliday or like Mary Alice, who, as we've established, is not Lisa Halliday, how we or one of us could write her way into a very, very different consciousness. And only by doing that do I think you stand the chance of learning that you're not that different from someone else as well.
You say you shouldn't go into that recklessly, or you should go in with humility. Did you go about writing that second section differently? Did you do research? Did you do reading that you didn't have to for the first bit?
Yes. Well, I did have to do reading and research for the first bit, but it was different.
What was the difference?
The first bit involved going back to some of my favorite books, because there are long passages from classic novels that are part of Alice's education. So I went back to books that I love and had read during this time in my life in order to find which ones, when assembled, would give a sense of how Alice is thinking about becoming a writer. And then there's just logistical research, like confirming which streets are where in Manhattan, that sort of thing.
Where there's an ice cream stand.
Yes, and what's on sale at Murray's Sturgeon Shop, that's that sort of thing. For the second part of the book, again, the consciousness of Amar is actually very similar to my own. So in a way, I was able to put more ideas of my own into that part of the book than in the first part of the book, because I made an aesthetic choice not to disclose many of Alice's thoughts. That seemed to me consistent with what a woman in her 20s is like. Not all of them, certainly.
Another distancing as well.
Yes, yes. For the second part of the book, I had to do so much research that involved, yes, reading books, watching documentaries, studying maps of Iraq and Kurdistan. And I interviewed multiple times a dear university friend who is Iraqi American and who was very generous with me, and I learned a lot. Also war correspondents. I read the work of war correspondents, in particular British ones, because the war correspondent in the book is a British man.
Another vexed question: did you use a sensitivity reader?
I've not heard that term before. So
there's another term that's sparked a certain amount of controversy over here. The idea that when you are stepping outside your own experience, and particularly where there are these issues of power imbalance or power asymmetries, that as part of the work on the manuscript, maybe towards a final stage, you might hand it to someone from that background with that experience to have a look at.
I did ask two people with an Iraqi background to look at the book. I didn't think of it in terms of sensitivity reading, more just as fact-checking, and is this credible? I'm not sure how different that is from sensitive. Certainly, if one of them had felt I had been insensitive, I think I would have liked to be told. But they both...
That's just a natural thing for you to do.
To
ask people to take a look at it? And
oh, yes, yes, yes.
Because, again, there are those who cry foul, who cry censorship over that idea.
Ah, no, I wouldn't. I worked on this book for a very long time. I think when you strike out like this in life, you must do the best job you can. And for me, that involves asking people to read it and to tell me what they think, from my husband to other writers. It wasn't a huge group of people, but people whose opinions I trusted. I've worked for a long time as a freelance editor and proofreader and a ghostwriter. I'm a very particular person. I'm a very precise person. And my work has involved for so long telling other people when they haven't been precise enough. So I suppose I was hardest on myself in that respect. And again, that for me, that involves fact-checking. I've never been a fact-checker, but I think I would probably enjoy that sort of job.
You can see the appeal.
Yes, yes.
You said that it was clear to you right from the start you wanted to put these two stories alongside each other. Was there ever any concern that by framing Amar's story with Mary Alice's, with Alice's, that would make it more remote from the reader, that would make it seem less real?
Well, no, I don't think so, because, as I said, I have an Iraqi-American friend who was at college with me, and we've existed in the same world. So he was always fascinating to me because he had a background so different from my own. He's also a brilliant, brilliant man and a very good friend. And that was one of the things that I enjoyed about going to college, was meeting people very different from myself. As I told you, I come from a very small quiet town in Massachusetts, and there were not very many people who were all that different. So that's what interests me, differences. I mean, as we know, the book is called Asymmetry, and I think people are attracted to differences. They complement us, and they, again, this is clearly a theme, they help you understand what you don't already know about the world. They broaden your world. They exponentially add to your experiences and understandings.
That was part of the idea, the part of the challenge, as it were, for the second section, to see if you could measure up to it.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
So why not just do that?
Well, because then it wouldn't be a story about writerly ambition. And it wouldn't be a story about asymmetry. I suppose you could say, well, there's the asymmetry between Lisa Halliday and Amar Jafari, but that assumes an external reference to the book. That assumes that you're reading the book with external references. And that's inevitable, of course. But I think the best books must, in order to be a very good book, a book must survive on its own terms, between its own covers, so that people who don't know very much about Lisa Halliday or Philip Roth or my friend from university who's Iraqi American still understand, still get the fullest sense of the themes that the writer's trying to explore.
So you think all that extraneous stuff gets in the way? Do you think it is, as Philip Roth said, a barrier between the reader and the work?
I think it can be. I don't think it always is. It's certainly true that reading Philip Roth's work has informed my own writing, and some people have said very intelligent things about that. I do think there's a fascination with celebrity, and that has perhaps given emphasis to an aspect of the book that is just one aspect of the book. I'm aware that many people may have become intrigued for that reason. I hope that in reading the book they will find a lot more to appreciate.
According to Orhan Pamuk, it's kind of one of the bits about fiction, where whoever writes it, wherever it is, he says that part of the power of fiction is that simultaneous experience when you're reading it of knowing that it's not true, but yet believing and feeling that it must be.
Yes, yes, you have to. And I've said this many times. A writer gave me the advice once to write as though you're writing in secret, as though no one will ever read it. I think a lot of people have interpreted my saying that as, that's the only way I could have written about a relationship that I had. But that's not really what I meant or mean. It's part of it, but it's also that you almost have to get into this, you almost have to play a psychological trick on yourself and enter a zone where there isn't truth or fiction. There's just what's best for the story. What is the very best narrative here? And you achieve it however you can. Again, you might take a detail from last week and plug it into a scene that takes place in 2004 because that detail makes the scene the best it can be to your mind. So, yes, it's a mess. I mean, it's very difficult to describe how one writes fiction, or at least how I do it. I don't mean to suggest that I know how other people do it, but it's a very strange trope that one must subscribe to for hours at a time. And you do almost become confused yourself, because what you're trying to do is achieve a quality that is so vivid that the rest falls away.
Do you wish now that, like in the case of Elena Ferrante, readers just didn't know?
I certainly thought about that. This will perhaps sound paradoxical, but I am a private person. I've never done social media. I spend a lot of time alone. I like spending time alone. But the relationship that I had is not a secret in my little world. We have many mutual friends. There's no way I could have published this book under a pseudonym and for people not to be talking about it as they are. And perhaps even more excitedly because I had tried to hide it. So yes, I think the fantasy is that you can write and be anonymous. But of course, even Elena Ferrante hasn't managed to do it. So yes, I wish I could. In a way, living abroad is a help. I recommend it to to aspiring writers living abroad.
You're living in Italy? No.
Yes, yes. I live in Italy. And as Ezra Blazer says in the book, there is the fatal froth and frenzy of Manhattan or New York literary life. And I enjoyed that so much when I was younger. I had a wonderful time, but it was very difficult to write in the midst of that because you're paying attention to the stories of other people's successes, and you really have to concentrate to write a novel. and that, for me, requires a lot of solitude and silence.
So what about for your next novel? Are you going to be mining your experience of the froth again?
I don't know about that. What I do know about it is that it's going to be set partly in Italy and partly in America. It is going to be in part about conspiracy theories, which is something I've been interested in for a very long time, long before they became of mainstream interest and
the
influence.
The major discourse of our time.
Yes, yes. They are, of course, a fertile subject for further exploration of fact versus fiction, and it's something that applies to life in Italy, because in Italy for longer, I would say, than in the United States, there's been a general sense of distrust of the government, of authority figures. There's always a suspicion that there's a story behind the story. I've said that there's a term in Italian, dietrologia, which literally means the study of what's behind. And that phenomenon governs a lot of Italian life, and it's deep in the psyche of Italians. And it seems to me an interesting comparison to make that to what's happening in America.
Lisa Halliday was speaking with Richard Lee, and Asymmetry is published by Granta and is out now. Next week, German Wunderkind Benedict Wells joins us to talk about The End of Loneliness, a family saga that has swept Europe and is finally out in an English translation. In the meantime, please do subscribe and review us on all your favourite podcatchers. And join the discussion on Twitter, @GuardianBooks, or by leaving a comment on the podcast page. Or, if you prefer to contact us directly, you can, as ever, email us on bookspodcast@theguardian.com. But for now, from me, Sian Kane, and our producer, Susanna Trezillian, goodbye and thank you for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.